Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Hidden Apron Radio with myself, Paolo Espanola. We're deep into fall here in New York City, or I guess what the new fall is, considering it's 80 degrees and humid outside. We have got another episode for you exploring the deep, diverse, and delicious world of food. We talk not only with the chefs, but everyone who touches the many aspects of our food from the farm to way beyond the table. We cover the stories of the individuals and explore their mindsets and the winding paths they took to get to where they are today. So in a way, these conversations are a window into how to create a life that's not just in trend, but a real, fulfilling, and sustainable one. And we happen to talk about food. Speaking of real, fulfilling, and sustainable, today's guest, who's in our own backyard here in New York City, is Mary Cleaver, founder of The Cleaver Company and proprietor of the just recently reincarnated Green Table restaurant, now known as The Cleaver Counter in Chelsea Market, and Table Green in Battery Park. Mary has been living and breathing local food since the 80s, long before it was cool, during a time when it was even scoffed at for being quote-unquote dirty. Her restaurant, The Green Table, has thrived since 2003 and just this past summer has relocated to a different space within the Chelsea Market. Many describe her company, which also provides catering and event services, as one of the most, if not the most, rigorous of its kind, as it is a B Corporation, i.e. a business that adheres to higher standards of social and environmental performance, transparency, and accountability. She's one of the most influential people, not just in the local food movement, but in the entire food industry. One of those people whose effects you've probably felt, even if you aren't familiar with her name, as she hasn't pursued what many others do, a fancy in-trend Instagrammable space, a cooking show, some loud male chef. So in this episode, we talk about the many facets of local food, not just why it's important, but why and how did we even get to where we are today, where we're even discussing local food. We talk about the history of American agriculture and how the industry has evolved throughout the years. Now, this isn't a rant against industrial ag, but rather a clear look at, you know, why are things the way they are and where can we go from here? For example, what should we be asking of our producers? How can we as individuals shop better? How do we cut through the noise of food marketing? And this is something even I struggle with because it feels like information overload every time I try to figure out what I should be eating. How can we leverage our underused power as consumers and what are the quickest wins we can achieve today? Yes, means eating less meat. No, it doesn't mean you have to turn vegan if you don't want to. We also talk about her business, seeing as it's been a stalwart despite being in such a challenging industry in an equally challenging city. How does she stay relevant? How to weather the down years? And how to recognize the god of big, but also worship the goddess of smaller by really taking a values-driven approach to growth. Bonus, we also talk about that time she took a weekend trip to New Orleans to get married. So friends, if there was ever someone today I would listen to when it comes to what it would take for us to eat in a way that's good for us, our communities, our planet, and yes, our businesses, it's Mary. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation with Mary Cleaver. Mary, welcome to Hidden Apron Radio.
Thank you.
I want to start with probably what I thought was a very rhetorical question, because loving food, when we hear the words local food, it's almost like a given, right? You're like, oh, of course it's good. But then I had a friend question me the other day saying, oh, what is local food even?
What's the point?
So that would be the second part is first, what is it? Why do we even talk about it?
Yeah.
So I think we should start there. I think that'll give a good context for the rest of this episode is what do you define as local food and why do you believe it's important?
Yeah. Well, you know, America, once upon a time in America, you know, there were lots of small towns and lots of farmers and, you know, a grain mill every 15 miles because that's how far you could get and back in a day from your farm. I mean, America was an agricultural country, and it was a big part of our settling of the country, I guess. Food came from nearby, or people grew their own for a lot of the history of this country.
Yeah.
And As you know, as cities got bigger and populations moved west and the megalopolis grew and gas and fuel became inexpensive in the 50s.
Yeah.
The Garden of America moved to California, and most of our produce began to come from the west.
Yeah.
To the east instead of from upstate to downstate. When I moved to New York in the late 70s, you couldn't find a local tomato in New York City in August.
Even though they could grow here, right?
Even though if you went out to New Jersey, there would be a farm stand and there would be farmers and raising produce and selling it. But the distribution system had really changed. And the infrastructure for local distribution had really dissipated over the latter part of the 20th century. And so even when, you know, growing up in New Jersey and southeastern Massachusetts, I knew that August was tomato month. And the tomatoes would be delicious then. But I couldn't understand why in New York City in August you couldn't find a tomato from 10 miles away or 15 miles away.
Is that a definition then? It's like, is there a certain mileage where you're like, that's local?
People define it in different ways. You know, my career, I've spent a lot of time working on local distribution and recreating it. For me, I kind of define it by where you can drive in a day.
Okay.
Because in the earlier part of the 21st century, I helped start a distribution service called Farm to Chef, where we worked with three counties in upstate New York to bring in produce and animal proteins from producers in those three counties. And it's, you can get there and back in a day.
In a day, sure. Yeah.
You can get from there to here and drive around and distribute and then go back.
Right, right. Why would that be important? Because I think someone could say, well, sure, that worked back then, but why would we want to return to that? If, I mean, sure, we created this megalopolis, and maybe that is the natural progression of civilization, then why is it important that we're even still talking about local food?
There are a lot of reasons for it. One of them is the health of our earth and the health of our population and keeping the soil healthy. Food that you eat close to the time it's harvested has greater nutritional value. And also anything that's largely water-based has much more flavor. The tomato, for example. So not only for health, but also for flavor, it's really important with vegetables, particularly to have them picked as close, to eat them as close to harvest time as possible. But I also think that we really need to preserve the health of our environment, of our landscape, of our soil and our watershed. And we need to do that by having pasture-raised animals on the land. And they fertilize the soil, and then we can grow healthy vegetables and grains, and we can keep the topsoil on the earth that we need to grow food.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, for the listeners who might not be familiar with terms like watershed or topsoil, I'll include links in the show notes. You know, when I try to look at this from a perspective of someone who doesn't care much for food, right? Someone who sees food as simply, this is fuel so that I can wake up the next day.
Right.
Right? And why would they not want to consider local food? Is it wrong for someone to make the argument that, like, with local food, we're not taking advantage of economies for scale, right? So, for example, if you can convert all of America to just grow soybeans, let's just all grow soybeans and then import that outside and have someone else who's really good at growing pineapples give it to us. Seems like a basic economic theorem, right?
But it's not, because, I mean, to my way of thinking anyway, right. Because for every dollar you spend in a local economy, you create 10. Mm. So it helps to keep the vitality and the economic strength of that community if you feed it.
Right.
So it's an economic question as well as a environmental question.
Right.
So it's important to keep our local economy strong and vibrant. And if we're not supporting our local farmers, then they're going out of business and we're building more houses. And it's also food security. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to know that our food can get to us from nearby.
Yeah.
That we're not relying on a carbon footprint of, you know, 1,200,000 miles or whatever it is. I mean, you know, there's some insanity in the fishing industry where salmon is caught in Alaska and it's sent to China to be filleted and then it's sent back to America. That just doesn't make any sense to me.
Why do you think that happens? Because even when I heard that story, I was like,
it is what? Economy.
You know what I mean?
It has to do with economics.
Is it a labor thing?
It's labor, okay. Yeah. It's like, and one of the reasons I started Farm to Chef was I progressed in my career. I just didn't, I started to wonder, like, why is it less expensive for me to buy lamb from New Zealand than it is from upstate New York? Well, it's because in New Zealand there's nothing but grass and sheep and beautiful landscape. But if yeah. I haven't been there, I'd love to go. But, you know, there's a lot of land for growing. Don't have as much of that. Mm-hmm. But and it also has to do with international exchange rates and currencies. And, you know, it's true that people have been moving food around the world since the beginning, since they were able to.
Right.
Spice trade. Right. You know, the hills of Rome are built on amphora that came, olive oil came from Spain into Italy. You know, there's a wonderful book by Sarah Murray called Movable Feast that talks a lot about it and different ways that this has happened over time. And I'm not saying that we should only eat local food. I'm so grateful that we can have chocolate and coffee and tea in our diet here in New York City. Mm. But the economics of that is important to me too, in that I want to make sure that the farmers who are harvesting that coffee in, you know, Ecuador or wherever it is, or that chocolate in Madagascar or Ecuador is being, that those farmers, those producers in Kenya and Uganda are being paid a fair wage for what they're doing, and that we try to leave as much of the money in that
local economy
as we can. Yes.
Right.
So, you know, bean to bar in country of origin is the best way to buy chocolate if you can, you know.
You want to strengthen
local economies.
Right. I think it's that part where you say it's like not just about the food, it's also the wages and the sustainability. And that's something that I only really recently even started to think about. I attended the Just Food Conference.
Yes.
And because even prior to this, I only saw it as it's simply a question of nutrition, when really it's more than that. It's a question of food justice. It's a question of inequality and all that.
And it's largely is a question of health too, Paolo. Mm-hmm. I mean, you said, you know, if it's food, it's nutrition. If it's food, it's fuel. But there's a big difference in kinds of food.
Right.
Some food is healthy. Not all food is healthy.
Right.
Not all food that's marketed to you as being healthy is healthy. So, you know, for me, the health of the soil is very important. That produces healthy food and healthy animals. And without healthy soil and healthy water, you're not going to have healthy food.
Right.
And so for me, I like to know where all my food comes from and what the practices are of the producers who raise it.
Sure.
And we now even, we have our own farm where we raise our own food. And that is an amazing thing, to be able to know everything about it.
Yeah.
And because feeding people is nurturing, it's a nurturing, caregiving, civilizing thing to do, right? And that's a big part of the joy in it is helping people to feel better, making people feel better, offering them health and nutrition and conversation around a table, you know.
I feel like those things are things that we, and I say this with a bit of me not having been there during those times, when we really saw food as just this, it was integral to being human. But today it's almost like, oh, it's such a chore, right? I mean, there are people who say, oh, let me just chug a Soylent because it's got whatever nutrition needs to keep me alive. I wonder if you could take us back to when you first started Cleaver Co. What were people's reactions to what you were doing? Because I'd also read that at the time, I also interviewed someone who's doing similar work in Minnesota. the epitome of being a chef or someone in the food industry was, oh, I ship all my stuff from France, or I'm doing this crazy, international cooking technique. How did people react when you said, hey, this is what I'm going to do with this company?
Well, I think, people have reacted well. And, there's been certainly a progression in my career because, mm-hmm. I remember the 80s too when we had Flying Food, Oh my gosh, we can get, these things from there so quickly.
Right.
And it was exciting. And then there was a lot of deterioration of flavor in some foods, certainly the waterborne ones, when we were getting, and then there was also the manipulation of vegetables, GMO tomatoes and that sort of thing. So people started to take what was a good thing, like, oh, I can get this truffle to you from northern Italy.
Right.
So you can have it in your meal. We still do that, right? But then there was also the aspect of that said, okay, I can make this tomato behave in such a way that it will look a certain way when I pick it in California, and when it arrives on your table mm-hmm. 3 weeks later, it's going to look the same because I'm going to manipulate the genes to do that.
Right.
And that was like the expense of flavor. And why do that? Food, one of the great joys of eating is flavor, right?
Yeah. And so you found that even in the beginning, people didn't react to this work of yours as, that's strange.
People did. So I became more and more devoted to, the more I learned about how unhealthy the food supply was becoming, mm-hmm. the more devoted I became to knowing where my food came from and knowing how it was produced and how it was raised, because I discovered all these things. I just read Orville Schell's book about all the antibiotics in the meat supply. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to be doing that. I didn't want to be eating beef that was full of antibiotics and testosterone, and that came from cows who were living in horrible feedlots, terrible in situ. That's not what healthy food is about. And so the more I learned about it, the more I became an investigative forager,
To learn
where my food was coming from and what I was feeding you, was. And so I became more dedicated to finding the right food. So I think early on, when I say early on, I mean, these are sort of decades go by, but in the 90s, it was more people would say, don't tell people, Mary, that your food is organic. They'll think it's dirty.
Really? And when they say dirty, meaning unsafe?
It's not going to be beautiful and taste good. Like crunchy granola, like hippie food co-op.
Yeah, gotcha. With like the grime still on it.
It's just like pulled from the earth and not, I don't know. So we how these things go, and like it's a woven fabric,
right?
The evolution of everything.
Yeah,
nothing is linear.
Especially the perceptions around things, like some of this stuff isn't new, and yet there's this new veneer to the local, sustainable. There's a certain sexiness to it that almost kind of deviates from what we should be looking at. But
How it's just a trend. It shouldn't be a trend. It's something that sometimes I imagine that the past 50 years in the food system will just be a blip on the radar of history.
I was just thinking that.
And we'll
today,
go back to healthy food. I mean, it took many, many thousands of years for agriculture to actually be developed in any kind of systematic, useful way.
Right.
There's an amazing book called Against the Grain, which I have begun to read.
By who? Do you know? I could look it up later.
Yeah, I'm blanking at the moment.
But
it's about how the transition from food gatherers, hunter gatherers, which we were once upon a time in Mesopotamia, to the beginning of agriculture, which brought a lot of turmoil and disease and created the hierarchical state, even. we all think of it as being, oh, it was born and here we are. But it wasn't like that. There were many thousands of years for that to develop into a system that was at all useful. And we still are messing with it, you know?
I forgot what the term is for it, of like forgetting that you're part of this longer narrative. Because oftentimes, even when I look at the food in the Philippines, right? These recent advances which really only came about when the Americans came during the war. Like, we have ancient cooking techniques that we've had much longer. Like, this is nothing new, that's, you know what right. I mean? If that was the reaction to your work before, how have what's it like now? You know, when people come into the restaurant or hear about your work and they see the message that you're pushing via the food.
Yeah.
Because pushing is probably a bad, not the correct word, because it's not like you're out there like proselytizing, right? But
I do a little bit, although to be perfectly clear, I am pretty hardcore about it.
The reaction changed?
That reaction has changed. I think we're in the middle of New York City, which is a pretty sophisticated audience, generally mm-hmm. speaking, or at least ours is. I mean, I'm in the catering and events business, which, you know, is, you know, to a certain extent, a luxury business.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I opened the Green Table was so that more people would have access to healthy food.
Right.
Because it's not a big financial commitment.
Yeah, it's a meal.
It's a meal. And I lost my train of thought.
I was asking about the reaction today.
The reaction today.
A better question is like, who are the ones who are reacting, whether that's positive or negative today? Who have you seen come and meet your work and have some sort of reaction to it? Is it the people who were born in that era that was doing all the gels and the aspics and the neon colored food, or is it like the new age millennial who sees this on Instagram? You know,
I think it's a broad range right now in New York. I think, and hopefully across the country too. And there's, you know, we have, there's so many sociological factors that are a part of food connects us all, right?
Right, right.
Something
right.
that if we're lucky enough to have access to it, we all have it in common.
Mm-hmm.
And so it affects everyone's life.
Mm.
And there's a lot of injustice in the food system. Really, in America, our agricultural practices are based on slavery, and still are to a certain extent. It hasn't, you know, whether it's whatever population it is underpaid and overworked,
right.
generally, and underappreciated and underbenefited, and underhoused. You know, the dairy industry, I mean, is really in serious trouble in this country. Dairy farmers are going out of business constantly because the money that they get for milk is now less than it was 50 years ago.
You mean in real terms? It's
in dollars and cents. Yeah, the per ton price is less.
So who's getting the money?
The middle people. It used to be that dairy, when I was a kid, grew up, as I said, in central New Jersey and in southeastern Massachusetts. And both places, we had a dairy that you could go visit where they milked the cows, they bottled the milk, and they delivered the milk.
Yeah, you had access to the supplier.
Yeah.
But that
was. And the supplier was, raised the cows, bottled, was the bottling plant,
was the distributor. Yeah.
But those dollars have all been dissipated through the economy now. So right. there are many, many middle people along the way.
And so this is what doesn't make sense to me. So this is a bit of me just personal curiosity now, is at some point the middle people are going to look back and say like, we've just lost their suppliers, right? I mean, I don't know, maybe that just seems kind of obvious, but
I mean, I think the economy keeps driving, these days there are dairy farms with 15,000 cows. You know, it's all about volume.
Oh, like consolidation of the...
More and more and more and more. Bigger, 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 bigger. That's what Earl Butz said, get bigger, get out. He was our Secretary of Agriculture under the Nixon administration, when I think was the beginning of the end for our agricultural system. And the idea of having cheap food became prevalent. Food shouldn't be cheap.
Yeah.
Food should be what it costs to make good food so that the people who grow it and produce it and care for the animals can make a living too.
It's artificially cheap.
Exactly. The yeah. costs are defrayed elsewhere. The true cost of American food is in the poisons running down the Mississippi River in the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah. It's in the topsoil being stripped from the Great Plains, from Iowa.
Yeah, and we have to even factor in like medical costs and all that. I think there's like all these external costs that we're not accounting for the cost of food, right?
That's right. And they are being paid for. It's just across the economy in different ways.
Yeah.
And the environment, let's not forget. The one we have, the one Earth.
Right. It's a scary thought. It's interesting you say that about the whole food shouldn't be cheap, because I've actually heard that quite a number of times on these podcasts. So actually, when I was talking to Ayesha, it's not only dollars and cents shouldn't be cheap, but it's also like a perception thing. Like, why do we have to perceive food as having to be cheap?
Shouldn't.
Or like, I think that was my challenge when I was first doing pop-ups, is people were like, why would I pay? I don't have money to pay $50 for a 5-course meal.
Yeah.
I'd be like, but you just paid $100 for a concert. Like, yeah. You do this like every other yeah. week. Like, yeah. Why is
or
it?
How much did you pay for that? Those three cocktails you had last night.
Right. Like, why is the person, you know, has that perception, how's that perception been like inculcated in us over time? Right. One of the challenges that I face though, and me being someone who already loves food, when it comes to trying to discern what is good for us, is today it's harder to filter out the noise. Like back then, we, you know, people would publish a book and it would be maybe a seminal work and we could all talk about the same thing. But today, I mean, just reading the news, all the fake news and everyone's got an opinion and articles. How do you advise someone who's growing up in this era of digital noise to be able to understand local food or what's good for them?
Well, again, I think it's very important to know how the food was grown and produced. So you can know your producer if you shop at a green market or, you know, which we in New York City were very fortunate. I mean,
right.
I came up with green markets. We kind of started at the same time here in New York. So, you know, there were originally 13 producers at the Union Square Green Market. And that was the one green market. And now we have, I think it's 55 or maybe,
yeah.
I haven't checked recently. It could be 60 by now. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's growing, 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 growing. And that's just in the Grow NYC system. There's other markets as well, which is wonderful, you know, because it brings local producers into the marketplace of New York City where we have 8 million people to feed, right? So that's what the recreating the distribution system was about, is trying to get local product into the marketplace of New York City so that our producers who live in our food shed and in our watershed area can survive.
So let's say that a person has figured out which farmer's market they want to go to. They've managed to carve out, because I also don't want to ignore the fact that getting to a farmer's market for some people is hard. I mean, there's a reason why things like what's the Fresh Direct or Amazon Prime is popular to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So let's assume that someone's managed to find the time to get to a farmer's market. They know what they want to buy. They get up to supply. What are some questions that they should be asking either themselves or the supplier to figure out whether this is something that they want to put in their bodies?
What are your growing practices?
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in regenerative agriculture? Do you use chemicals in your food? How are your chickens raised? How do you raise your beef? Are they raised on pasture, which is a natural solar system of agriculture where the...
Meaning like eating the on grass,
the
grass.
The grass grows,
yep.
The cows eat the grass, they ruminate, they fertilize the grass,
right.
The sun shines, the rain rains, and it all grows again. So it's a closed system. We've turned it. Michael Pollan wrote about this, you know, in his books, you know, the Omnivore Dilemma, and that we now have a fossil fuel-based system of agriculture where we are busy, you know, growing grain with fuel to feed the cows who don't want it anyway, you know, corn to feed the cows who can't digest it until they're at least 18 months old. And, you know, we put them in feedlots and feed them corn and give them antibiotics and so that they can not get sick when they eat the corn. And then we give them hormones so they'll grow faster and we can feed them less and slaughter them sooner. And
I remember, like, when I was in grade school hearing about this, I used to think, like, oh, this is some sensationalist propaganda where you just show some disgusting video of a feedlot and it was meant to make us disgusted. I'm like, but there's an agenda to this. But the more I read into it, taking away the disgust factor, what you're describing just seems insane. There's a certain insanity to it. Like, right, if I think the what was the statistic they threw out? Were like, of all the food grown in America, most of it doesn't actually go to human beings. Right. Like, it's used to feed an animal where they don't even really eat the stuff that we're growing.
And those crops are subsidized by the government too. So, you know, that's another economic concern, that the crops that are subsidized are not the ones that people are eating.
Generally. Given all these changes in not only the perception of local food, but also the system itself, right? Obviously, there are things that are better. We now have more green markets. And I'm sure there's a lot of things that are also worse, like the average age of the farmer, for example. In your eyes, what's gotten easier for you, for your work, versus what's gotten harder?
Well, one of the things that's gotten easier is we now have about 15 distribution services in New York City who will bring local product directly from the farms
compared
into the marketplace.
Compared to
when I started Farm to Chef, there were none.
Mm.
Yeah, or one, maybe.
Sure.
So that's very positive. That's a very positive step.
Mm-hmm. What's gotten harder?
I think what's gotten harder is that we've sort of went through this period where everything was working better, and I think things are working better. But what's gotten harder is that a lot of people, there's a lot of marketing, there's a lot of co-opting of natural or sustainable or these terms that don't have any validation.
Right.
And they're thrown around.
Is it called like greenwashing?
It's called greenwashing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that marketing is sometimes our worst enemy to health in this country.
If we took just a very small slice of marketing, just social media, right? Because one, I saw that you guys have Instagram, like I'm on it too, and for listeners of the show who grew up in the age of social media, have you seen that it's net positive or negative for you?
Oh, I think it's net positive. I think that we're a little bit underrepresented ourselves. We have to kind of up our game in that because it is important, the Instagram and social media is, you know, I've been doing this now for 40 some years, right? So the younger population uses Instagram. They don't use websites. They don't use, you know, word of mouth.
Yeah.
If it's a good picture, then it's a good thing.
Yeah. Right?
Sometimes that can be without substance or experience.
No, true. And that's why I ask whether it's net positive overall, not just in usage, but the effect on perception. Because I was at a food conference, for example, where Alton Brown was speaking.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about social media. And he was like, you guys realize half that stuff we don't even want to eat, right? Like, who wants to eat a geode? Have you seen those cakes, the ones that look like crystals?
No.
So it's basically a cake, but they make it look like crystals from like a cave are growing from it, like gemstones.
Yeah.
And he's like, these are all these,
and yeah.
There's videos of all of those, and he's like, but who actually wants another geode cake or another 30-second video of how to make a waffle biscuit with like fried chicken and I don't know, some sort of candy? But it's basically being made just for optics rather than food.
Well, you know, my background is in art. I studied art in college, ceramics and painting. I mean, all of my early clients were art collectors, and I believe in beauty, and and a visual presentation. Mm-hmm. But because I think we do, you know, as I said before, eating is something that appeals to all of your senses. Mm-hmm. So it starts with the eyes, but it's you know, how it smells is a big part of it too. So what it looks like, what it smells like, what it tastes like, what it feels like when you eat it, you know. And that's an important thing that I think our food supply is taking advantage of, the tongue and the taste factor.
Yeah.
And people just say, oh, it hits salt, sweetie, fat, salty, sweet, fat. It's good all at once. But never mind, you know, how you feel after you've eaten that bag of Doritos, right? The Dorito effect, right? So you have to, it's not, instant gratification is not the only thing in life, right?
Yeah. Although that's a more philosophical question, because I feel like even outside of food, instant gratification is, you know, what drives sales, right? If I could tell you that I can get this to you in 10 minutes less.
I know.
You
know,
I was at a Food Loves Tech conference last year, and they were like, what company was trying to figure out how to deliver pizzas by drone? And he's like, getting your pizza an extra 10 minutes early isn't
good. Yeah.
Like, you're not changing anything.
It's not what we should be focusing on, I don't think.
Mm.
But you besides farmers markets, though, you can also shop or wherever you do like to shop. I mean, if it is by box delivery, you know, we think Andrew Kimbrell turned the phrase, like, we're not consumers, we're creators, right?
Mm.
So we as eaters can say to your box delivery service, I want to know how healthy this food is. I want to know, you know, I don't only want it just to be convenient to my door, but I want to know that it's making a better food supply as you purchase it. I care about the ingredients that you use. I care about my health and your health and the health of the producers.
Taking aside, you know, let's assume that people aren't willfully ignorant, right? Because sometimes people do think ignorance is bliss. Do you believe that we underestimate our power as a consumer?
I do. Demand? I do think so. I think, and I do think that we need to take our place in the economy and understand that how you spend your money makes a difference.
Mm.
If you direct your dollars toward the local regional farm and food economy, you're going to put more money back in it, and you're going to make those farmers survive, help those farmers survive and even thrive. What a wonderful concept.
Yeah, so the argument that, like, I'm just one person, like, I'm not...
No, I don't buy that at all. Gotcha. Every person has power.
Yeah, got you. Okay. Emma actually sent me a whole list of suggested reading before I got here, and I managed to read through this older article that Bittman wrote on one of his columns of his, like, manifesto. And he listed out all these things that he thinks should happen for us to have a good, healthy food system. You know, he was like, get rid of subsidies for unhealthy food. We should maybe even subsidize home cooking. There was sin taxes, reducing, you know, reliance on, like, the Western diet of, like, highly processed, a lot of meat.
Yeah.
And it was basically a whole laundry list.
Yeah.
I'm sure you have your own list. If you had to say, like, this is what I think is what we need today, that we could implement relatively easily, practically, and it wouldn't get such a huge backlash against public perception, what would those 1 to 3 things be?
Well, I think really understanding how animals are raised is important, so that you're not endorsing confined animal feeding operations, you're not endorsing a poultry system that puts thousands of birds in one barn together. You're not endorsing feedlots for cattle. You're not sourcing fish that's being overfished and on the brink of extinction. That we're not eating bluefin tuna. That we're allowing fish populations to regenerate. Those are all important things to do.
It sounds like, because all those things that you just mentioned go around the all proteins, well, and all meats.
Let's eat more vegetables too. I think if you know, there's a program called Meatless Monday. So if you spend one day where you don't eat meat, that's very helpful too. Frances Moore LePay wrote an amazing book called Diet for a Small Planet in the 70s, where she pointed out that we could feed the growing population of the world if we ate a more plant-based diet, because it takes 16 pounds of vegetable protein to create 1 pound of animal protein.
Right. And that's not necessarily an argument that everyone should go vegan, though, right?
No, no. I don't believe that everyone should go vegan. I think it's fine to eat animal protein. I just don't think you need to eat it 3 times a day.
And I bring that up just because sometimes like people will jump to the conclusion like, oh, are you telling me I should be vegan? I'm like, well, no, there's a spectrum, right?
No, there's a spectrum. Yeah. But you don't need to you do not need to eat meat every day.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And I mean, I respect veganism. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't feel that I'm certainly an omnivore.
Yeah. Like, it's not the silver bullet, or it's not a black and white, like it's either you're eating meat or you don't.
No, like, but you can be sure that the meat that you are eating, it was properly raised and properly slaughtered and is contributing to a positive food supply.
As an individual listener then, who's listening to this and just thinking like, what can I do as a single person besides spending my dollars towards the local food economy? Would you say understanding your meat consumption would be one of the biggest impacts you can have on the food system?
I think it would be, yes, I think it would be really good. And I also think really understanding the fish consumption would be important too, because the oceans are part of our earth.
Right.
They're not just a dumping ground or a place to be pillaged. You know, we have to respect the regenerative population. We have to respect and regenerate populations there as well.
Yeah, it's almost hard to grasp when you see this big blue ocean, right? And that's why it's harder for people to imagine like what's going on underneath, right? Yeah. If that is what we can have a big impact on as consumers, what's the flip side? What are things you think, like, what's something that we all are putting all our efforts in thinking that it's a solution? But really, it's a non, or the impact would be so minimal, right?
Well, I think that, I mean, it just, I sound like a broken record, but you know, I think a lot of the gluten I've never seen a trend as huge in my 40 years in the food business as the gluten free trend. And I think a lot of that is because we're eating grains that are dead. You want to buy grains from, you know, a healthy source, we have in New York, the Regional Grains Project, which is just amazing. We have a lot of, New York used to be the breadbasket of the country, right? And we're now beginning to reinstate that. There are a lot of grain growers in the Finger Lakes area. We have some in the Hudson Valley as well. So we're trying to bring that back.
Yeah.
And not just eat processed food. Cooking and not eating processed foods would be a really important thing to do.
Oh, I love how you said cooking. This has been like my longest, the thing I've been talking about the most. Like,
cooking is what people need to do.
I was like, this is not a look, like, we need to start cooking more.
Yeah.
And that's why when I saw Bittman say, hey, we should probably subsidize home cooking, I'm like, you know, if you did that, maybe more people would cook.
Yeah.
But, you know, whether that's a practical thing.
I mean, it's hard, right? To have a lot, you know, everybody works.
Yeah, no, it's tough. And I love cooking. It's tough.
You know, especially if you have a family and kids and parents working, and you know, how do you, and I get it, like, you have time to shop or you have time to cook, but you don't have time to do both,
right.
You maybe choose one over the other. But that's why if you're going to shop from a Fresh Direct type service or Blue Apron, you know, who does try to focus on using local product, you know, you really want to ask them for that.
Before I move into the, because I'm a little over halfway, to actually just you personally, how you've managed to not only survive, but thrive through all these years. From a business perspective, from when you look at other businesses who are trying to create a better food system, are there solutions that they're doing that you're like, that's overrated? So a while ago, I talked about, you know, the company is trying to make pizza delivery by drone, right? Yeah. Are there things that other companies are trying to do that you're like, guys, like, really, that's not...
Well, I think one of the things that we, you know, I spent years and years thinking about where things come from, and then I started to think about where they go. Mm-hmm. I think we've created a tremendous amount of snack food that's just nothing but, creates nothing but waste to go in the landfill. You know, I think that's another area that would be very good to focus on. You know?
So less snack food companies, more...
Yeah, less packaging.
Got you. Huh.
How many wrappers and, you know, like, yeah. I mean, I'm a capitalist, right? I run a business. I believe in free enterprise. But I do think that we can have it with values. And I think that one of the values that we need to focus on is how we protect the earth.
Yeah. I think
and
the term
creating
was like...
waste does not protect the earth.
Yeah. Yeah. The term that I was reading on the other day was like the triple bottom line. Like, it can't just be like profit,
people,
planet.
Planet, profit.
Yeah.
In that order.
See, I got the order wrong.
You know, there. I once was at a workshop years ago at a Kellogg Society conference, and there was a workshop on paradigms of American business given by a man named Kenny Ossibel, who's a scientist, and he was talking about and nature, everything is interconnected and interdependent. It's a web.
Yeah.
You know, everything relates to everything else. And the American business model is about vertical growth. That's what we were talking about earlier.
Sure.
Bigger, grow. Bottom line.
Yeah.
The bigger you get, the bigger your bottom line. And there's only one thing in nature whose only mission is to grow, and that's a cancer cell.
Oh, I was going to say virus. Yeah.
So yeah, it's a pretty powerful analogy.
Yeah. I mean, that's why you see these movies where they imagine some external being, whether it's like a alien from another planet looking at humans and like, you guys are the worst virus, you know that, right? And it's like, oh, it's a very harsh mirror to look at.
I don't watch those because, you know.
It's just a depressing thought.
It's too real.
Right?
Yeah, we seem to me, in my mind, to be a population bent on suicide. We're poisoning our population.
Yeah. There is hope, though.
There's hope. Oh, yeah. There's hope.
You're listening to Hidden Apron Radio, produced by myself, Paolo Espanola, and Ricky Ho. Just two ordinary guys trying to break bread and break boundaries. Thoughts, musings, ever just wanted to rant at us? Do let us know at hiddenapron@gmail.com or at hidden_apron on both Twitter and Instagram. Back to the show.
This question is, there was no other better way to word this, but not because it almost sounds like I'm implying you should have closed earlier. But Green Table, for one, has been open, what, since 03?
Yeah.
Here? In Chelsea Market, of all places. In New York. Like, the most trend-happy place in America, I would say. What would you credit your longevity to?
Well, the Cleaver Company comes before the Green Table, right? Mm. So, the Green Table was, you know, was born out of the catering and events business. Mm-hmm. I think that the Green Table is, you know, the food is good, it's not expensive, and it's in a busy marketplace. Mm. So that's part of the survival of the Green Table. Quality is really high, and the service is good. So, and the catering business is same. I mean, it's a quality product. Mm. It's very specific to, you know, each event is different, and a lot of time and attention is paid to make sure that each client gets what they want, and that it's delivered, you know, beautifully in delicious fashion, and that the production is as high value as the food, quality.
Sounds like, first and foremost, it's already an exceptional business, even amongst non-local food focused businesses?
Well, thank you. I hope so.
No, because I think it's very modest of you to say, like, well, we have a good quality product, when a lot of companies will say that, but they can definitely, they won't be doing that for 40 years, right? Were there times where you have thought, like, oh my gosh, we're not going to make it?
Oh, yeah. Every business has ups and downs. Small business is very challenging and gets harder and harder.
What was your most memorable moment where you really thought, yep, this is it. This is the drop.
Well, you know, there have probably been a few of those. Mm. Certainly the 2009 recession was really tough.
Yeah.
We had to lay off 30% of our staff at that time. That was a big regrouping. Mm. So that was a tough time. Certainly, I would say that was probably the most challenging economic time.
Yeah.
If you're talking about economics, yeah. I mean, certainly 9/11 was a very difficult time as well, for so many reasons. But, you know, we were, some good things came out of that for us as well. I mean, we were hired by St. Paul's Church to deliver 200 dinners a night to them, where the rescue and recovery workers were being sanctuaried, as it were.
Wow.
It became a sanctuary for them. And the food supply had become very unhealthy because New Yorkers wanted to help, right? They were taking food and putting it out on Canal Street. I mean, the rats went wild.
Yeah.
And they were already greatly displaced from all the bombings. And,
yeah.
I mean, the crashing down of the trade towers, and it was a little bit of chaos. Well, there was a lot of chaos for quite a while, but St. Paul's became the sanctuary, and we were asked to prepare food for them, and that we did that at cost. The Episcopal Church funded it. We did it at cost from September through June.
Mm.
And that really helped us stay in business, because not a lot of people were having parties.
Were they familiar with your work previously? Because,
well, the man, Martin Coward, who came to run the sanctuary, I guess is really the best description of it, there had a food business in Tribeca down the street from mine when we were in Tribeca for 15 years before we moved to Chelsea.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought of me and came to talk to me about it. And we were able to do that.
Right. And me being uneducated in this, like, my knee-jerk reaction would have been, oh, there's a crisis, let me just get the cheap... Like, when this happens in the Philippines, you get the canned Vienna sausage and the non-perish... Like, the cheapest food you can get.
Yeah.
Right? And so for them to reach out, I was wondering, like, wow, like, that's either very... What's the word? Foresightful? I don't think
foresightful. Well, it was a wonderful and generous thing that the Episcopal Church did.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
To provide that.
And yet here, you know, despite the challenges, you're here today. You're still here today. And nowhere close to looking like you're in the weeds, although I wouldn't know. I am in the front. But one thing that I've noticed coming here and eating here is it still feels very fresh. It you know, sometimes you go to these places that are iconic, they're older, and you almost go just because of nostalgia. But yet, for some reason, it still feels very fresh. And when I went to that dinner where Cynthia and Monique collaborated on that dinner, right? I mean, the menu that came out was, there was Japanese, there was Moroccan. And
well, that's what's so fun about cooking. I mean, we draw from the cuisines of the world, but using local product.
And that was going to be my question is, what's your thought process on making that possible and keeping it fresh? Because when you think of local food, sometimes people say, like, oh, I'm restricted to just this.
Well, as I said, we do work with it. My philosophy in general is that if it grows here, we only use it when it's in season,
mm-hmm.
or in some added value form.
Right.
So canning or frozen, preserved, pickled. But yeah, you just get creative, you know.
It's entirely possible.
Parsnips to make hummus, you know. You think outside of the box. You think across. We have wonderful, you know, we have an international culinary team here.
Yeah.
People come. Monique is Jamaican, and Emilio is Peruvian via Japan. And you know, we have, Gabby's from California. I mean, we have a variety of intelligence, you know, culinary right. intelligence that we are so lucky to have.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Paulo, you know what it's like to cook. It's a creative process. So you. I mean, my cooking is very market driven, you know, mm-hmm. what's best in the market is what we work with.
So. Yeah. I asked that and in full disclosure, it's a completely leading question because I wanted to show that using local food is not restrictive. And in reality, it's actually a lot more liberating because if you are using crappy produce, even though it's, you know, flown from somewhere else and you could get it all year round, because it tastes bad, you have to do so much more to make it taste good. And well, so you're restricted in the way you could be creative with it, right?
Right. Yeah. No, sometimes, you know, disciplines and limitations give birth to creativity.
Right. Right. Right.
Structure, yeah. A certain kind of structure that we have here on how we provision.
Yeah. The freedom of limits or something. I forgot what the term was when dealing with creativity. You talked earlier about how you now have a farm, and that was actually one point where I was like, is she crazy?
Yeah, we're crazy.
Right?
Totally is, crazy.
One, you got it relatively recently.
Yeah.
And two, you're not only a full-time farm, like you're doing all this.
Yeah.
How is it possible?
My husband's the farmer.
Right, well, you're still married to a farmer who is married to a caterer, who you know.
Yeah, we are a little bit.
What keeps you? What keeps you sane?
Keeps me sane. Well, I love going to the farm, and you know, having time to slow down and be in nature a little bit, and dig in the dirt, and you know, feed the chickens, and you know, see the beauty of nature. And breathe the fresh air. And, you know, I'm very fortunate to be able to do that. Mm. I think that we do suffer from nature deprivation in the city a lot. I think, you know, I'm on the board of Hawthorne Valley Farm, which is a 900-acre biodynamic farm in the Hudson Valley that has a very strong place-based learning program to get kids on the farm, to teach them about farming and to be in nature. I think we need that as humans.
Mm.
And we don't have enough of it, those of us who live in the city.
Right. What's your if you had to release like a state of US farming report, like what would your outlook be on the state of US farming?
Well, I think that we need to have some changes in food policy. I think we need to have some changes in our administration. We need to have elected officials who appreciate where food comes from and that there is a difference between healthy food and unhealthy food. We need to not only worship the god of big, but also the goddess of smaller.
I like that. That should be that's a quote. That's a t-shirt right there. That's a t-shirt. You could have a little like mascot, the goddess of smaller. You could totally have a new branding campaign on this. I don't know how long you've been thinking about that.
I just you inspired it. Just came out of my mouth.
If you had to, so let's say that they asked you for like a summary, like a one-pager grade. Like if you had to sign a grade A through F of U.S. farming today, what would the grade be? And second, do you think it's on a downward or upward trend?
Oh, geez. I hope it's on an upward trend, but I don't know.
How about the grade today?
I mean, that's a sort of a broad question. What do you mean by farming in the U.S.? Do you mean our farm policy? Do you mean the food that's produced in this country?
I would say considering a couple of factors, right? Taking out perception on farming, just the ability of the farms today in the U.S. to continue to feed the U.S. in a healthy way. So taking into account many factors, the average age, the wages, the soil health, if you had to assign like an average grade and say, you know what, we're like a B minus.
Well, I think we're more in the D category.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Got you. And you
C minus.
Bordering on D. And yeah. And the biggest thing that would make an impact is better food policy, would you say?
Well, better food policy would be helpful. I think we need to change the kind of subsidies that we have. I think that we don't need to, I think we need to pay some credence to producers who are protecting the health of the land. I think organic farming should be honored and respected, and that it shouldn't be a fringe thing. And when I say organic, I mean really regenerative agricultural practices. I don't mean just something that has an organic label.
What do you mean by it? Because I don't want to assume that everyone knows the terminology, but what is regenerative?
Regenerative agriculture is kind of a deeper dive into sustainable organic, I guess, because I feel that those concepts have been co-opted by others.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a kind of love-hate relationship with the USDA organic certification. It doesn't take into consideration animal welfare in a way that it ought to. You know, it's very, it's limited.
Sure.
To say the least.
Sure, sure.
Organic isn't really the be-all and the end-all in my mind. I think regenerative is a better way of phrasing it, because it has to do with regenerating the soil and the earth and life cycles. Yeah. In a way that's life-giving.
Potentially what...
Rather than deadening.
What the spirit of organic would have been before the certifications came to be.
Yeah, kind
right?
of. Yeah. And it took 10 years to build it. I mean, it wasn't
the certification
lightly.
Program,
yeah.
You mean? Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, as soon as they became... I happened to be in Washington the week that they came into practice. And, you know, immediately the Beyond Organic movement was started in Nora Puyol's restaurant, you know, where there were press conferences and a lot of talk about that.
Yeah, yeah.
How the organic standards were not, they weren't the end of the line.
Yeah,
there
was still a lot more work to be, yeah. I've been reading on the certifications and all that on New Food Economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like, oh my God, like there's so much we haven't even.
Yeah.
Because I thought as a consumer, I'm like, oh, it's got the green stamp. I'm good to go.
I'm good.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm good. No. Right. It's like, but I realized, and it was a hard look in the mirror to realize that the stamp was simply like an absolution of guilt.
Yeah.
Right. If I don't have to ask anything more, if I see the stamp, I'm good to go.
Yeah. No, you're not though.
Yeah, exactly.
Good for you for realizing that.
The last section here is questions that I've asked everyone on this podcast. But before we go there, because you are definitely the expert in this compared to me, who's just beginning his journey in all this, is there a question that you feel like I haven't asked?
Well, I think that you've really hit on it, actually, because we talked about how you think if it's food, you think it's healthy, and it's really important for people to look deeper into it and to read the ingredients on that box, or just don't buy the box to begin with. You know what I mean?
That's a good one.
Just don't buy the box.
You know how they have that, like, think outside the box? Literally.
Don't buy
There's
it.
There's so many quotables today. Like Green Table, if you guys came out with shirts, like a whole shirt line, you'd have quotes for days, you know?
We're going to have to let you do our marketing.
Oh, man. Careful what you wish for. So this last section, as I mentioned, is a bunch of questions that are super short. You don't have to answer them short. You could answer them as long as you'd like to, but essentially I've asked this on every podcast. First question is, person who most influenced you from what you're doing today around food?
I think my children had a lot to do with it, because once you become a mother, you begin to care in a whole new way. I mean, when I was 16, I thought, oh, I'll never have children because it's such a horrible world to bring children into. But then, you know, nature takes that over.
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky to be a mother.
Yeah.
And when you start thinking about this brand new infant and how you want them to live a strong and healthy life, you think about what world they're living in, and you want to make it better. And also, it was shocking to me to discover that there were poisons in my breast milk. That was something I had not ever thought about.
Wow.
So it's insidious and pervasive, the poison. I'm using it as a general term just because, you know, that it's kind of, they're kind of, there's either healthy, there's healthy food and there's unhealthy food.
Right.
And you just want to look for the healthy food.
Yeah, right. Second question, best food-related tool you've purchased ever? And it's not, you cannot say the knife.
Cast iron skillet.
I don't know how many, one day I'm going to have to remove that from the list. Everyone, everyone, there's been at least three or four people with like cast iron skillet. Like everyone. Okay. What brand of cast iron skillet is that?
Well, I buy them at tag sales because I like the old ones that are just, that don't have the big thing on them. They're just.
No, but what do you mean by the big?
Well, there's the ones that they make now have a, on one end of it, they have kind of a bracket that you can use to hang your pot up.
Oh.
But I find that very annoying because it just takes up room in the oven in a way that is
Yeah. I've ended up using that as just a second handle, but every time I put it on the stove, it bumps into the wall.
Yeah, it's a pain. Yeah.
Got you. Okay. Now I know also, where to look for them.
My stove is amazing. I have to say the stove I have in my home, which is a stove that I used to start my business, and it came out of one of my clients' Park Avenue apartment. She was redoing her apartment and wanted to get rid of the stove, and it was the same time I was building my first kitchen in 1981. And she said, you know, you can have it. If you can get it out of here, you can have it. So we took it apart and moved. Didn't even fit through the door. It had to be taken apart to get through the door of the apartment. All the apartment around it up on Park Avenue.
I thought you were going to say like this like silver, sleek, space age stove something.
It's my, and Ashley, my husband, wanted to get, it has two clocks on it and he wanted to get the clocks to work.
Yeah.
So he's kind of called around the country and he found some technician in Florida.
Get out of here.
No. This is the kind of guy he is. He's the farmer now. Right? 35 years in the film business and now he's a farmer. He wanted to be a farmer at age 60. The technician said, oh, yeah, that's the one. It's a Magic Chef. So that's the one we used to call the glamour model. We'd put it in the window. The glamour model. We put it in the window of the shop to bring people in. And when we took it all apart, it's serial number 16.
What?
Yeah. And when we moved from Tribeca to Carroll Gardens, where we live now, so, you know, it couldn't come here to be the professional.
Sure.
But it went, so we moved, anyway, in finding a house, there were two things. I needed a house with more light and one that my stove could go in.
I'm going to Google image this stove, because now it sounds like a mythical, like, workhorse, you know what
well,
I mean?
Come to dinner sometime. Right? I'll cook for you at my house.
Again, careful what you wish for.
That would be great.
This is my favorite one. Three ingredients to describe you. And food ingredients, by the way, because I had one person go like, honesty, and I'm no, I meant food ingredients.
Butter fat.
Okay.
Onions,
okay.
And lavender.
That was it. Why? I've got to go back and ask, why onions? Is it because you make people cry? You're multi-layered? Like,
no,
what's the story behind the onions?
Because onions you can use in so many different ways, and they bring a lot of flavor and substance to any dish.
Yeah. Okay. If you had to suggest... Oh, this is going to be tough. If you had to suggest one resource to the common person... You'd see their book, documentary, article, whatever. You're like, everyone in the world should see this just to become a better human being in general. What would it be?
Oh, that's a hard question.
I know. Especially because I'm sitting in front of a bookshelf and your suggested reading list was humongous.
I know. Yeah. It's an important question, too. There are a lot of things coming to mind, but I haven't picked out the one yet. God, I need a minute on that one.
We'll go back to it.
Good. Let's go back to that.
this next one, the fact that we've been like throwing quotables around is perfect. If you had to distill your message, all your work, into a book, and this book only had one page, and you could only write one sentence, what would it read?
Know where your food comes from, and make sure it's contributing to health, good health.
Fantastically hard to do in today's world, I will say.
Yeah.
That one line is, could write volumes out of that. This last one's more of a logistical question before we go back to that resource one. Where can people follow your story? This is your plug now. Any upcoming cookbooks, any websites, Instagram, whatever you, where do you want people to look?
Well, we do have a website, cleaverco.com.
Okay.
We do have Instagram.
I will get the link on the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
So you have two options. It's either one, we go back to the resource question.
Yeah.
Or if you need more time to think, you finish your New Orleans story.
Okay, well, let's finish the New Orleans story. So
I think we stopped off in... So you've been reading the news lately. You know how, like, Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump are about to meet?
Yeah.
If you had to cook them dinner, what would you cook them?
Gumbo.
Gumbo?
I just kind of fell in love with the cuisine in the early years of my career.
Yeah.
Because it's such a powerful regional cuisine, but it also represents so much of American cuisine in that it brings together various... It's such a melting pot cuisine, right? And it has such strong influences from Africa and the Caribbean, and also from the French, because the Acadians went from Canada to Louisiana. So it's just kind of brings together so much.
Yeah, I was just there 2 weeks ago. I was just there 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
After dreaming for 5 years to go back.
Yeah,
and I keep telling people like. It's simultaneously un-American, but very American. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So. And plus that it also, about the time that I got so interested in it. So I started cooking. I always loved to cook.
Yeah.
But when I moved to New York after college to find a job, I found cooking to be my most marketable skill. So I kind of embarked upon this.
Marketable skill?
Yeah. I needed a job, you know?
Yeah.
I thought, I could be a nurse or I could be a cook. You know, I love to cook.
Yeah.
Those are jobs that you all, job security.
Yeah.
Right? And food and healthcare.
Yeah.
And I like to care for people, but I would so much rather spend my time in a kitchen than a hospital. Anyway, I love to cook. I'd done it since I was a little girl and, you know, all through my high school years, you know, like I discovered cake. Mixes and then I discovered you can make a cake and then I discovered with flour and sugar and butter and like gonna go back and then I learned about French cooking from Julia Child.
I saw that quote where like you cook your way through the
book but not in its entirety, let me be clear, but you know, and really the my biggest food awakening happened when I was a girl, when I was 10 years old, because my family had the really great good fortune to spend a summer in Paris. We traded houses with a friend of my father's. Mm. They came and lived in our house, and we went and lived in their apartment on the Bois de Boulogne and shopped every day at the markets. And then we traveled around France, and we went to Normandy, and we went to
Paris. Well, does it sound like you got the better end of the deal?
We have a pretty nice house in southeastern Massachusetts on Buzzards Bay. It was a lot of good times there.
But, yes.
And furthermore, just for starters, we took the Queen Mary over.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, my mother was a daughter of the Depression. We never ate out. I'd never really been to a restaurant other than, you know, the Chinese restaurant in the shopping center once or something. You know what I mean?
It just
wasn't something we did.
Yeah.
And so on the Queen Mary in those days, you had to probably... I mean, very, very formal service. waiters and stewards jackets,
you know, like white gloves, dinner and all
seating,
that.
The you know, the captain's table. I mean, it was very formal French food.
Yeah,
and it was amazing. And then in the afternoon, because it was a British boat, they had tea on the high deck.
Like after, like high tea.
High tea on the deck, and they would bring out a pastry cart just laden with Napoleons and eclairs and, you know, all these gorgeous French patisserie. So, and then when we went to Paris, and then you could go to the patisserie, you know, and there they were on it, you know. Yeah. It was just, so that's when I, and then, so the French cuisine was kind of, I mean, I grew up in central New Jersey and southeastern Massachusetts, so on the water, so we would, you know, go to the dock to buy the fish and go to the local farm stands to buy vegetables. So I was, I'm old enough to have grown up eating good food. And then, you know, learning about the regional cuisines when we were in France, because it was, they were so different wherever you were. Yeah, so New Orleans, you were asking about why it's important. And we talked about it being, it's kind of the melting pot of American cuisine. I mean, it represents a certain amount of what's great about America, I guess, and what is great about American food, and that it brings all sorts of things together. But I became fascinated with it because I just love the mixing of the spices and the, you know, the hot and the seafood. It just brought together a lot of things for me that I that I love very much. And so when my husband and I had been together for 10 years and we decided that we maybe it was time to get married, so being in the food business, there's not much time you have to get away. But at the end of January, we went to New Orleans and got married there. So we eloped to New Orleans. So that was, that's why, another reason it has, I'd never been, I wanted to.
You got married in New Orleans.
To experience the cuisine. So we left New York on a Thursday morning, I guess, or Thursday afternoon anyway. Friday morning we were at the, you know, we were at the Café du Monde, and Ashley went down to City Hall to see what was involved, and, you know, and they said, well, oh, geez, how long are you in New Orleans? Well, 3 days. Oh, no, you know, it takes longer than that, unless you get a waiver, boom, boom. They you know, so it's like all about, like, we want you to do this.
Yeah.
You know, the longest wait we had was at City Hall for the judge to come back from lunch at, at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon. And then you know, ate oysters and
the oysters Rockefeller
barbecue shrimp and, you know, amazing food. We went to Pasco Manali's for our wedding dinner. And went to Mosca's, which is out of town, had baked oysters, and we just, you know, had just had a wonderful, you know, 3 day.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
I
and friends of ours from California had met us there. They didn't know we were going to get married, but my husband's oldest friend in the world. So they were our witnesses, and we, you know, so it was just fun time. There's a funny story about calling my parents to tell them that we'd gotten married.
Yeah.
And my mother sort of got on the phone, and I said, well, we got married. And she started, because this was like, this was before cell phones, right? Like, you didn't call people all the time. Maybe once a week, you know, to check in. And she knew we were out of town. Like, why were we calling? What was wrong?
Yeah.
So she started shrieking to my father to get on the phone. So he did. He said, well, we went to see the judge. And it was dead silence. And that was a euphemism that he used for people getting married. And I said, well, we got married.
Yeah.
And he started to laugh. And he said, oh, I thought you got arrested.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. Well, you said it that way. I thought it's because you got it arrested.
Yeah.
Oh, man. New Orleans. I really think if New Orleans said we're going to be our own nation, I'd be like, I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. Like,
we have been back once since then.
You gotta go back.
I know.
Especially there's this guy who does... I don't know if he's based in New Orleans, but this guy who does, like, Nigerian cuisine, but he's also, like, a social activist, and he uses food to advocate for certain issues.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, the food culture there is very vibrant. It's not powerful. In the Instagram-y way, and no, it's rooted.
Well, it is. I mean, that's Yeah, maybe that's what it should be, Paolo. Everyone should go to New Orleans.
Yeah, and fall in love with food.
Yeah, the one thing you should do.
Except that their food awakening won't be on the Queen Mary. It would be like on the steamboat Natchez or something. Do you have an answer for the resource question?
The resource question.
Or will you have to send it to me after this recording?
I might have to. I can't think of it.
Let's do that.
It's too big a question.
Well, you're doing very big work, you know? Final thoughts.
Well, this has been really fun. So, it's so interesting that you're doing this and wonderful that you're doing it.
Yeah.
Because food is what connects us all. So the more food stories, the better, right?
Yeah, yeah. And the more varied the stories are. It's not like one person like yelling from the rooftop of one single thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
No, you're so welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
The sun is shining today.